Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on my last program, I was talking about, well, maybe a little bit about, motivated by nostalgia, perhaps, but recently I've been thinking about California, my roots, where I'm from, the history of California, and some of the stranger things about California, elements from history that are curious. And on my last program, I was talking about one of the two main candidates for the mythical figure of El Zorro, the character that we know from the television program in the 1960s, and by the way, the actor in that television program, the man who played El Zorro, his name was Guy Williams. So yes, I have the same name as a television actor. Guy Williams later went on to play the father in the television series Lost in Space, the original one, the one from the 1960s. Now, it's quite possible that my parents would have heard that name being floating around. It might be that they named me Guy in part because they had heard the name of the actor and it sounded good to them. In any case, so we have something in common. By the way, that actor, whose original name was Costello, I believe, in any case, that actor, if I remember correctly, married an Argentinian and went to live in Argentina, where he became fairly well known. And that is where he died. I remember that one morning in Madrid, I was driving to an early morning class. I was on the Castellana when, on the radio, they began the news program by saying, "Guy Williams ha muerto." And I thought, no. He hasn't. News of my death is exaggerated, but no, they're talking about el actor norteamericano, que things, ha muerto en Buenos Aires. They were not talking about me. They were talking about the man who became famous for El Zorro. And of course, before there was a television program, there were countless books and comic books and other popularizations of this story. But of course, let's go back to the real person. Okay, on yesterday's program, I talked about Tiburcio Vázquez, who is one of the usual suspects for being the model, the prototype on which El Zorro is based. However, Tiburcio Vázquez was a bandit. No more, no less. And many of the things he did, he tried to justify by saying that this was a kind of vendetta, that this was in revenge against the Anglos for stealing California away from the Californios, or away from the Mexicans who had been living there before the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But in reality, as I mentioned, it's more like Tiburcio Vázquez was simply a bandit. And he was trying to deflect, he was trying to avoid the guilt of his own crimes, pointing the finger in another direction, or attributing his crimes to motivations, you know, to a pristine motivation. Now, in the case of the person I'm going to speak about today, Joaquin Murrieta, it's much easier to see him as a victim. Murrieta originally came from Sonora, Alamos in Sonora, in Mexico. And we have record, Constancia, we have record of him being baptized in 1830 in Alamos, in Sonora. As you know, gold was discovered in California in 1849. And all of a sudden, the population increased exponentially. People from all over the world came to California in the gold rush, Fiebre de Oro, the gold rush. And those people, mostly coming in 1849, they were all called 49ers. He's a minor 49er. So, among these 49ers, you have Joaquin Murrieta. He left Sonora and went north, went into California, California which had just until the year before been part of Mexico. Now, it was going to be part of the United States. It had petitioned for recognition as a state. Now, in 49, hoping to discover gold, hoping to strike it rich, this is dar con el oro, to strike gold, a lucky strike. That's where we get that term. He was trying to strike it rich, and he spent his days panning for gold. He was able to get a very, very good property, right? A site for mining. And so, as a prospector, he was relatively prosperous, or at least this is how the story goes. Now, this idea, he brought with him his beautiful young wife, and they were working together looking for gold. Now, the discovery of gold in the area meant that lots and lots of Anglo miners were there. And immediately all of the ugliest passions and racism came out. All of it obviously driven, propelled by greed, avaricia. No, the greedy miners were trying to do anything they could to keep other miners out. And if they could do that legally, then so much the better. So there was actual legislation in the California Assembly to try to restrict the mining claims to white people. And I know that Mexicans should be considered as white people. But as I say, racism is always relative and always being redefined. So, yes, if you don't like them, then you call them non-white. That's what happened to the Chinese who came in enormous numbers. They say that 30% of the people in the gold country, the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, 30% of those people were Asian, mostly Chinese, but some Japanese. And efforts were made, legal and illegal, through violence, to prevent them from prospecting. And the same with the Mexicans. And, of course, Murrieta. Murrieta suffered for this. Now, the story is that a group of neighbors, prospectors, demanded that Murrieta give them the claim, give them the right, no, la escritura, the right to prospect in that area. And when he refused, things got really ugly. The story is that the prospectors tied him up, and while he was immobilized, they forced him to watch as they first raped, violaron, they first raped and then killed his wife, or they raped her and allowed her to die of injuries suffered during that brutality. So that Murrieta obviously wanted revenge and was quite willing to dedicate the rest of his life to revenge for this atrocity, this outrage. Murrieta quit his claim, left the area, worked in something else. But at one point, he borrowed a horse from his half-brother, right? He had a hermanastro, he had a half-brother working nearby, and he borrowed a horse from that man. On the way back from town, a group of people surrounded Murrieta, stopped him, detained him, and insisted that the horse had been stolen, that he was riding a stolen horse. Murrieta truthfully denied all knowledge. Of course, he couldn't say that the horse hadn't been stolen. He didn't want to say anything. However, they evidently whipped him with a whip, no? Le azotaron, le flagilaron. They whipped him until he told them where the horse had come from. This uncontrolled group of people, and when we talk about an uncontrolled group of people in English, we generally use the word mob. This is like the turba. This is like the, again, a group of people capable of anything. In English, we use the word mob. It comes, of course, from mobilitate, something from Latin. The mob. The mob went to the house of Murrieta's half-brother, took him out of the house, and lynched him on the spot. So he was hanged in this extrajudicial sort of Well, in this climate of racism, violence, and of course, who knows whether he was guilty or not, but if that somebody should have called the sheriff. In any case, at that point, Murrieta decided that enough is enough. He wanted justice. And this is why you can imagine that he was considered sort of emblematic of all of the Mexicans who stayed in California after it became part of the United States and were mistreated and suffered from prejudice. The terms of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo said that the physical person and property of those Mexicans that wished to stay on, that all of that would be respected. But of course, in practice, once the Americans had taken over, there were all sorts of acts of injustice, especially in terms of land. Land was simply stolen. Claims to land, the deeds, right, the escrituras, in many cases were not recognized by the courts. That this was a pretext for stealing the land. In any case, Murrieta decided to do something about this, and over the next couple of months, many of the people who had been involved in the mob, the mob that lynched his half-brother, and of course, the smaller group of people, the gang that had killed his wife, many of these people died. They were found dead, and in many cases, dead and mutilated. So, a case of revenge. Now, Murrieta fell in with a gang of bandits. One of the bandits, one of the main bandits, one of the people in charge, had lost two fingers in the Mexican-American War. He was Three-Fingered Jack, or at least that was his nickname. That's what people called him. Three-Fingered Jack. And they decided that they were simply going to steal as much gold from the American miners as they could. Their options for getting that gold honestly had been taken away from them, and so now they were going to do it dishonestly. Almost immediately, the gang became notorious. We saw this in the case of Tiburcio Vázquez on my last program. There was a reward on his head, right? There was a price on his head, wanted. In the case of Vázquez, it was a wanted captured, not dead or alive, but captured. First 1,000, then 3,000, then 5. And in the end, was it 15,000 they were asking? And so that was an amount of money that was just too tempting to pass up. So, yes, in the case of Vázquez, somebody turned him in. Somebody denounced him. But in this case, Murrieta was too clever. And evidently there was nobody who was safe, or nobody who at least felt safe from his revenge. Naturally, people began to talk. Naturally, there were rumors circulating, and it was rumors for good and bad. Already at this time, Murrieta, who was living as a bandit, he was called the Robin Hood of the West. Now, the U.S. Army sent one of their superstars to hunt him, a man named Harry Love. And yes, that's a real name. Harry Love. Harry Love was given free rein, rienda suelta, free rein. He was given free rein to bring Murrieta to justice. Love had also fought in the Mexican-American War. And he wanted to do in California what he had been doing in Mexico. Love began to look everywhere for them, to track them, right? La pista, the track. To track them down, and caught them in flagrante at a local ranch in the middle of stealing a group of horses. They began to shoot at each other. It was a firefight. And the horse thieves were killed. Now, this all happened, and while this was happening, it was very, very clear that one of the horse thieves was three-fingered Jack, obviously because of his distinctive hand. So they took three-fingered Jack, and they took the person that they believed was Murrieta, right? This was, photography was not common at the time. And there was really no way to identify whether this man was in fact Joaquin Murrieta. They took him and decided that they wanted a souvenir. So yeah, three-fingered Jack, they took off his head, they beheaded him, they decapitated him, and Murrieta as well. They took off his head and went with the head to San Francisco. In addition to which, in the case of three-fingered Jack, they took off his hand as well in order to preserve and display the hand with its, of course, distinctive three fingers. Now, of the two, of course, three-fingered Jack was not the important person, not the person they had been ordered to find, not the person they were sent for, right? So Jack's head began to decompose. In the end, they simply threw it away. However, in the case of Murrieta, they found a container, a jar, big enough to hold the head and something to preserve the head in. It was possible to see the head of Joaquin Murrieta, or the person who they were telling you was Joaquin Murrieta, possible to see that on display for the low, low price of only $1. Remember that in the middle of the 19th century, $1 was quite a bit of money. But with the California gold rush, with gold circulating everywhere, there was an enormous, an exorbitant inflation. And for many people, $1 was practically nothing. Yeah. People paid, all kinds of people paid good money to see the preserved head of Joaquin Murrieta. It became celebrated. The head itself was lost in the earthquake, the big earthquake, 1906. But Murrieta continued as a symbol and as a celebrity. I'm going to tell you about that after the break in just a couple of minutes.
Mira, los de Baugan.
Claro, están aquí en la calle Orense 69.
No, ahí en la esquina.
Anda, es verdad, han abierto una tienda.
Abierta de lunes a jueves de 10 a 2 y de 3 a 7 de la tarde y los viernes a las 11 de la mañana.
¿Tus hijos tienen entre 10 y 18 años? ¿Quieres mandarlos al extranjero a aprender inglés este verano? Sin riesgos y con total confianza, mándalos a un campamento en Canadá con Vaughan. Pasarán 4 semanas de acampada en un paraje de ensueño junto a chicos y chicas canadienses con muy pocos alumnos hispanohablantes para que tengan que comunicarse en inglés sí o sí. Nosotros nos encargamos de todo para que no tengas que preocuparte de nada. Vuelo de ida y vuelta, alojamiento, pensión completa, actividades con monitores, todo incluido en el precio. Llámanos ya al 91-133-5832 e infórmate sin compromiso. Campamentos de Inglés en Canadá, 91-133-5832.
Vaughan y Víctor Ullate sumaron sus décadas de experiencia en la enseñanza del inglés y en la formación de danza y artes escénicas para crear un campamento único que ayudará a los participantes a desarrollar todo su talento artístico.
La Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate cuenta con más de 30 años de experiencia en la formación de danza clásica, danza moderna y artes escénicas. Junto con Vaughan hemos creado una inmersión lingüística a través de múltiples actividades, juegos, talleres, de manera que los niños en el campamento no solo se formen y demuestren su talento, sino que se sientan también seguros y muy cómodos con el idioma.
Buscamos fomentar la faceta artística y creativa de los niños a través de una formación especializada en el mundo de las artes escénicas en un entorno angloparlante, donde pierdan el miedo a hablar en inglés y utilicen el idioma en su vida cotidiana mientras se divierten y desarrollan su potencial. Son las últimas plazas. No dejes pasar esta convocatoria. Campamento Vaughan con la Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate. Infórmate en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. Now, on the first part of this program, I was talking to you about one of the candidates for El Zorro. A man named Johnston McCulley was looking around for a historic figure, somebody important, to base a novel on. And the novel was called The Curse of Capistrano. Capistrano is one of the missions, one of the California missions, all built going north from San Diego de Alcalá, starting in San Diego, all the way to north of the California Bay. Originally strategic, originally meant to stop the Russians from coming south. The Russians were in Alaska. The Russians owned Alaska, and they were establishing colonies, hunting colonies for nutrias, for otters, and other things. They were going south. And of course, if Spain had done nothing, they would have continued south, all the way down into Baja California. So they decided to make it a priority to establish missions in Alta California. And one of them was San Juan Capistrano. It's one of the most beautiful. If you go to California, I encourage you, I recommend the mission of San Juan Capistrano. Now, in this novel, The Curse of Capistrano, Johnston McCulley tells the story of a Mexican native of California named Don Diego Vega, who takes on the persona of El Zorro. It's his alter ego. It's he puts on a mask in order to do that. What he wants to do is to fight for the poor people, the oppressed people, and the people who have been faced with injustice as a result of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and the transfer of California from Mexico to the United States. Now, this was, of course, not the first time that anybody had written about something like this. And just as the figure of Batman is clearly based on El Zorro, right? They admit it. I mean, the creators of Batman, instead of making him a Californio, instead of putting it in the 19th century, they wanted to make him ultra rich. I don't know why. And in Gotham City, Gotham is a synonym for New York. So, yeah, New York, but Gotham City. And, of course, in the 20th century. Well, just as Batman was based on El Zorro, El Zorro was based on a book written shortly after Murrieta died, The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta, the Celebrated California Bandit, written in 1854 by a man named John Roland Ridge. John Roland Ridge, whose original name was Yellow Bird. John Roland Ridge is actually as interesting a figure as Joaquin Murrieta. The Cherokee tribe was in the way on the East Coast. Right, more and more people were coming, and the Cherokee tribe had land that people felt was very attractive, and so this land was given to Europeans, and the Cherokee were forced to move as far west as they could to a completely different kind of place, completely different ecosystem, completely different way of life. And this has been called the Trail of Tears. So, yeah, many, many of them died. The negotiations previous to the Trail of Tears, to the expulsion from their ancestral home, sent to Tierra Yerma, no, to very barren land. Well, in this, you can imagine that the Cherokee didn't know whether to resist, to agree to what terms, to try to negotiate for better terms, to look for legal representation. They just didn't know what to do, and it was intense and polemic. So yeah, Ridge's father and grandfather and cousin were all Cherokee leaders. And they believed that the only way to get out of this would be to simply give the federal government what they wanted. Resistance would be much worse. And so they were willing to sign with the American government. Now, they did this in their own name. They did this usurping permission. They did this without the approval of the Cherokee National Council. They did this without consulting the chiefs. In the Spanish Empire, they were called los principales, right? The head men. And they signed that treaty in 1835, giving the territory and allowing for the elimination, the removal by force of the Cherokee. Now, 4 years later, when Mr. Ridge was 12 years old, some of the indignant members of the tribe who believed that Ridge's father had betrayed them, some of them came over and killed him. They killed his father, they killed his grandfather, and they killed his cousin for having signed the treaty. And, Rich's mother was a European. Rich's mother was not a member of the tribe. Her name was Sarah Bird Northrup. And with her husband gone, with her grandfather gone, with any sort of protector gone, she decided that she was not going to live with the tribe anymore. So, yeah, this boy at age 12 leaves the Cherokee before the really, really terrible things happen along the Trail of Tears. Leaves the Cherokee and goes to Fayetteville, Arkansas. Remember, it's Arkansas? No, Arkansas. Fayetteville, Arkansas. And there, Ridge grew up, went to school, studied law. In 1849, remember the year that everybody is going to California, Mr. Ridge killed one of the people that he believed was responsible for the death of his father, grandfather, and cousin. And this was, of course, 10 years later. But we always say, revenge is a dish best served cold. In any case, he had to get out. He had to get out quickly, get out of Arkansas, go anywhere. And why not? He moved to California. Now, the clever people didn't mine. The clever people were not the prospectors. The clever people, they were the ones who stayed and tried to sell supplies to the miners. On an earlier program, I spoke about Emperor Norton, the Emperor of the United States, protector of Mexico. Emperor Norton was one of these people. Levi Strauss, with his blue jeans, Levi's. Levi Strauss was another of the people who got very rich selling supplies to the miners, rather than going looking for gold, which was extremely disappointing for the great majority. So, Ridge began to write. Just like Samuel Clemens, right? Mark Twain, who was there at the time. Bret Hart, who was there at the time. Many great writers. And at one point, Robert Louis Stevenson was there. Many great writers around the gold rush trying to give us an idea of what it was like. So yeah, Ridge became a journalist, a writer, a poet, an editor of several newspapers. Now, as I mentioned earlier, although the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo stipulated that the Mexican inhabitants could choose to remain in California and be American citizens, and although the majority of those people chose to remain, I mean, they had property. They had things to lose, right? You can't just pick up and go to Mexico. Go south, go to what is now Mexico, that easily. In any case, California's new constitution had restricted voting rights to white men. No one else could vote. Meanwhile, as I mentioned, the federal government was not honoring the property rights of the Mexican citizens. And so, the newcomers, the newcomers coming in 1848, there had been only about 15,000 non-natives in California. The indigenous peoples were fairly numerous. I spoke on an earlier program about the fact that perhaps 10% of the indigenous peoples in what is today the United States, about 10% of them lived in California, although, let's say, the level of social organization was not very high. These people were living in the Paleolithic or early Neolithic in terms of their, talking about the social development. So, 15,000 non-natives in 1848 to 165,000 in 1850. Just 2 years, and the population has gone up exponentially. We're talking about increased by 11 times. They say that from 1846 to 1873, perhaps the indigenous people at that time, declining from 150,000, 10 of them to every one European, from 150,000 to 30,000, an 80% decrease, a demographic collapse. On an earlier program, I talked about the last Indian who came out of the deep forest in the end of the 19th century. Ishi, he called himself. Ishi, which in his native language simply meant man. Now, they wanted to legislate this racial, again, superiority, rather a kind of a codified racism, a sort of apartheid, into the Constitution. And, well, voting rights, for example, the Chinese could not testify in court, meaning that if they had been the victims of a crime, there was actually no way for them to denounce that crime or look for legal redress for justice from the justice system. Native Americans who were guilty of being vagrants, of not doing anything, right, of sitting around. This is a law so that the policeman or the sheriff, if he doesn't like you, he can say you are lazy, you're not moving enough, and simply arrest you. In this case, Native Americans facing the charge of vagrancy were often forced into working, the forced labor, hard labor. And, yeah, other sorts of ugly treatment, violence, mob violence. This is what Ridge wanted to write about. Naturally, a lot of people don't like seeing the ugliness, the bad side of society, even when it surrounds them. A lot of people, when they pick up a book, they want entertainment. Well, Ridge, again, looking for justice, looking for a hero, he writes about things that, it's also very complicated. For example, Ridge, back in Arkansas, had owned slaves. He had been a master to slaves. But, he was absolutely opposed to abolitionism and was very much in favor of the side of the Confederacy during the Civil War. And yet, he is seen as a defender of Native Americans, especially the Cherokee, and of Mexican Americans. However, in Joaquin Murrieta, the book he wrote, the California Indians are portrayed, are depicted, are described as completely lacking in any civilization, as being cowards, and also in this novel he says very, very bad things about the Chinese as well, so that three-fingered Jack, right, the one that was in the band, well, the one, I guess, that led the gang that Murrieta was in, Three-Fingered Jack, terrorizes the Chinese. And we are supposed to identify with Three-Fingered Jack in this novel. And things get complicated. Things get complicated. So, Ridge believed that there were many different kinds of Indian, and that the civilized kind, you know, the Choctaw, the Chippewa, the Cherokee, his kind, his tribe, the civilized kind should be treated, should have the same rights, duties, privileges. They should be treated the same way that the Europeans are, because they have a similar level of civilization, whereas other indigenous peoples should not. Indigenous peoples who are not civilized must be civilized by force. In The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta, by the way, Ridge spells it with one R. And the man's name was Murrieta, but Ridge spells it Murrieta, one R. In this, he talks about the, again, Mexican bandits robbing white and Asian miners and travelers and other people, and he makes it titillating, right? Practically pornographic in its descriptions of violence. And he talks about, or rather he writes about all sorts of things, including the head. The head that went on display all across the state of California, the head of Joaquin Murrieta. Love and his posse, the people who followed him, they got $6,000 in reward money for that head. But of course, In Ridge's novel, you have to doubt that they got the right person. So yes, the book is filled with melodrama, filled with bravado, and filled with graphic violence. Yeah, the hero, Murrieta. The hero is impeccable, beyond reproach. The hero is with a melodrama, you need something from soap opera, right? A telenovela, something from un culebrón, right? To keep it going. The good have to be all good, and the bad have to be all bad. This book was such an incredible bestseller that it's what people base the idea of the romantic bandit in California on. And of course, Zorro in The Curse of Capistrano, which was written, by the way, in 1919. Thoreau uses a lot of the vigilante sort of style, the methods and the romantic and chivalrous, caballeresco, no? The chivalrous nature of what's being done. This is an echo of what Ridge wrote about describing Joaquin and his fellow outlaws. Again, as I say, Bob Kane, who created Batman, recognized that Thoreau was a very important influence in the creation of Batman. Thoreau and Batman concentrate on individual justice, but it was Ridge who emphasized the idea of injustice, social injustice, racial injustice, and how this was going to affect things. Again, not something that everybody wants to read, but something that is fascinating and curious. Okay, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Estás escuchando Bon Radio.
Mira, los de Baugan.
Claro, están aquí en la calle Orense 69.
No, ahí en la esquina.
Anda, es verdad, han abierto una tienda.
Abierta de lunes a jueves de 10 a 2 y de 3 a 7 de la tarde y los viernes a las 11 de la mañana.
I learned English at a very young age, and that's why I studied translation. Every mistake you make is actually an opportunity to learn. My daily activities are in English. I talk in English every day with my boss, with my
Be like
colleagues.
Juan. Be like them.
Descubre más en grupobaugan.com.
El pueblo angloparlante de Vaughan gana decisión y seguridad en 6 días de inmersión en inglés. Disfruta de un entorno privilegiado y mejora, por fin, tu agilidad oral y comprensión auditiva. Piensa, habla, vive en inglés. Llámanos al 911-133-5833.
Después de nuestros summer camps, no querrán volver a casa. Apúntalos a uno de nuestros campamentos de verano en inglés, sin clases. Este verano, regálales una experiencia.